Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is three-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and military historian Rick Atkinson, the 2015 Peggy V. Helmrich Distinguished Author winner. Atkinson is best known for his Liberation Trilogy, three highly acclaimed volumes documenting the U.S. military's role in liberating Europe during World War II. The first volume, An Army at Dawn, won the Pulitzer in 2003 for history. The second and third volumes, The Day of Battle and Guns at Last Light, were highly praised as well, with a New York Times reviewer referring to his narrative style as pointillistic history, telling a number of small stories that, when viewed as a whole, give readers a complete view of a large story. Atkinson has also won Pulitzer Prizes for national reporting in 1982 and public service in 1999 for a series of investigative articles he directed at the Washington Post on shootings by the District of Columbia Police Department. His other books include The Long Gray Line, a narrative saga about the West Point class of 1966, Crusade, a history of the First Persian Gulf War. He also wrote In the Company of Soldiers, an account of his time with General David Petraeus in the 101st Airborne Division during the invasion of Iraq of 2003. He served as a reporter, a foreign correspondent, and senior editor for 25 years at the Washington Post. You can meet him when he receives the Peggy Helmrich Distinguished Author Award from the Tulsa Library Trust. The public presentation will be Saturday morning at 10:30 at the Hardesty Regional Library, and he joins me today on Studio Tulsa. Rick Atkinson, welcome to Studio Tulsa, and congratulations on the Helmrich Award.
Well, thanks very much. I'm grateful for it. The list of previous winners is daunting, to say the least, but I'm very much appreciative of the recognition.
Well, your own writing is quite great and quite varied, although we know you for your military histories. As a journalist, you wrote about all sorts of things. And while I know you came from a military family, you turned down a chance to go to West Point, or it didn't work out for whatever reason, and you became a journalist writing about a great deal of subjects. What led you to write about the military?
I think it is the fact that I came out of a military family. My dad was an Army officer, enlisted in the Army in 1943 and came back from Europe in 1946, went to college and then back into the Army to make a career out of it as an infantry officer. Yeah, I blundered into journalism. I actually started in a small paper in Pittsburgh, Kansas, not too far from Tulsa, and found that even though I had had no experience as a college newspaperman, that it was something I really liked, and ended up in Kansas City after my time in Pittsburgh and eventually a long career at the Washington Post. And I think because I actually knew the difference between an M-16 rifle and an F-16 fighter plane as an Army brat, I was given assignments early on at the Post in writing about military issues. I had written about the West Point class of 1966, another story I kind of blundered into when I was in Kansas City. And it just became a bit of a specialty. I feel comfortable around the military. I speak the lingo. I know the culture. And that propelled me into eventually becoming a historian, focusing largely on military history. Again, I think it's a fairly natural progression, even if it wasn't predictable 40 years ago.
How did you blunder into what eventually became The Long Gray Line, your first book?
Well, I was in Kansas City, and my dad's closest friend from the early 1950s, when he was a young lieutenant, was a guy named Red Fuller, who eventually became the commanding general at Fort Riley, Kansas. And Red had a son named Mike Fuller, who was in the West Point class of 1966. I had known the Fullers since I was born in Munich in 1952. And Mike, one day, we were actually driving toward Tulsa, as it turned out, because we were going to my brother's wedding in Iola, Kansas, driving from Kansas City. And this is 1981. Mike started telling me about his West Point class and about how they had had more men killed in Vietnam than any other West Point class, how they had charged off to war, determined to win the war and come home to ticker tape as their fathers had in World War II, and how the schism in the country over the issue of whether Vietnam was a legitimate war or not played out within their class. And I was captivated by the tale he was telling me. I went to their 15th reunion that year at West Point in October 1981. I wrote a series about it for the Kansas City paper. It won the Pulitzer Prize. And I stayed in touch with them. I went to their 20th reunion 5 years later, and at that point, I thought about it as a book. They had spent 20 years in the military, those who had stayed in the military, and I felt like I was old enough, mature enough, experienced enough to be able to take what had been a newspaper series and turn it into a narrative history.
How much of attrition took place in that class? I mean, other than the fact that you had a greater percentage die in the war, how much of their experiences in the war caused an attrition in that class? Because we think of West Point as being sort of the groundling for the professional officer class.
Well, that's very true. There were 579 men who graduated in that class. It was all male in 1966. And they stampeded out of the Army after their four-year obligation to the Army in exchange for a free education had expired in such numbers that the Army commissioned a study in the early 1970s. It was called Why They Quit, Resignations from the West Point Class of 1966. 30 of them were killed in Vietnam and Cambodia, many others wounded. These were platoon leaders in a platoon leader's war. Many of them went back for second tours as company commanders, as captains. And during the time that they were being young officers in Vietnam, something had changed in the America that they had known, that the America that they had left in 1962 when they went off to this hermetically sealed place called West Point. And they found that they were no longer considered leaders of their generation. They were really pariahs for many folks in this country who confused the warriors and the war. So they did stampede out of the Army by, you know, the early 1970s. A third of them had left the Army, and those numbers continued to accumulate. There were some, of course, quite a number who stayed in for at least 20 years, a full career, and retired. And then there were others who went on to large things. So Wesley Clark graduated first in that class. He was a Rhodes Scholar from Arkansas, became a four-star general, the NATO commander. There were others, George Crocker became a corps commander as a three-star general. Now, of course, they're in their 70s. I always think of them as 18-year-olds on our day, reception day, when they first show up at West Point. But now they're aging, and the schisms that the war caused really played out for years and years in the class. They had to make peace with each other over the war, what it meant, over the deaths, and the fact that some of them had real doubts about the war. So it is a fascinating sociological study.
Now, in your book, In the Company of Soldiers, you follow the invasion of Iraq in 2003, and I'm sure you've kept up with some of those people that you spent time with, many who again perished in the aftermath of the attacks. Do you see any parallels between that class of 66 and that war you covered?
Well, I did go off. I was between books, and in the early months of 2003, I went off to Kuwait and then to Iraq with the 101st Airborne Division. And the commander was a young major general just taking command of the 101st named David H. Petraeus, whom I had known a bit as a major, but didn't know him well. And I got to know him very well because I was with him all day, every day for 2 months during the invasion up through Baghdad. I see some parallels in the sense that there were a lot of misconceptions at the beginning of the Iraq War about why we were going to war, how easy or not it would be to win the war and come home. I have to say that Petraeus had private doubts about whether or not the strategy was legitimate. So this was interesting for me, being with him all the time, seeing somebody who's got full responsibility to get the 101st Airborne deployed to Kuwait, get them into Iraq to fight the war, and yet having some doubt. This is a guy with a PhD from Princeton who's got a big brain and is thinking through whether or not this is the approach that the country should be taking in the Middle East. And yes, I've stayed in touch with him. I'm still in touch with Dave Petraeus and Dave Fivecoat, who was then a captain. His aide is now a colonel. He commands the Ranger Training Regiment. So, yeah, there are some parallels. Now, it's a much smaller war. The deaths, certainly during the invasion, were minimal compared to Vietnam, but ultimately we have more than 4,000 dead in Iraq, and a sour taste, I have to say, in the mouths not only of those who served, but most of the country has some grave doubts about it.
Now, you've written books about conflicts you've covered, both Gulf Wars, but you've also written about books you've only experienced through secondhand research, World War II, and I understand you're writing a trilogy of the Revolutionary War now. How does writing about those different conflicts change when you have that personal experience? How does it affect your writing?
Well, I actually think that having been a journalist and having been a foreign correspondent, a war correspondent, having the experience of being in nasty places like Somalia and Bosnia and Iraq a couple times, I've been in Afghanistan, makes me a better writer, a better historian, particularly a military historian. I have some visceral sense of the relationships between commanded and commanders, of the nuances of infantry combat, the importance of things like light discipline, making sure that there are no lights showing at night and so that the enemy doesn't know where you are. I think that actually the experiences that I had as a journalist in these latter-day wars helped me to write with greater authenticity and perhaps greater empathy in writing about World War II. I spent 15 years of my life writing a trilogy about the American role in the liberation of Europe in World War II. And an infantryman is an infantryman, whether he is fighting in 1776 in New Jersey or whether he's fighting in Iraq in 2005. There are certain eternal verities of combat and infantry life and camaraderie and fear, all of the things that go into the extraordinary and sometimes horrifying thing we call war.
Now, did you find many instances of people writing about that later, that fear? Because, you know, a lot of times you'll see accounts where it focuses on everything but that sort of visceral fear, you know, the funny things that happen away from the battlefield when you're looking at sort of homemade memoirs and such of a conflict.
Oh, there are plenty of accounts from World War II, for example, and I've spent a lot of time looking at the 45th Infantry Division, for example. That was the Oklahoma and New Mexico National Guard, a really fine unit that had some very difficult times. And I follow them, writing about them, having done research at their archive in Oklahoma City, from the time they arrived in Sicily in July of 1943. And I picked them up again after the Italian service that they did in southern France. And you find soldiers writing about how scared they are. That's not terribly unusual. There's rarely a stigma attached to being frightened. And good commanders, good non-commissioned officers will tell soldiers that, of course, you're going to be scared. There were lectures given on the boats headed to Normandy in June 1944 from a smart commander who said, it's going to be confusing, you're going to be scared. It's going to be terrifying. That's okay. That's absolutely natural. The thing is that your training is to see you through this period of fear, and we'll get through it together.
Mm. Now, the decision to write about the Second World War and to write a trilogy specifically with so many books about this conflict, what was the viewpoint you wanted to get across that you hadn't read previously?
I had a hypothesis, I suppose. I lived in Berlin for several years as a foreign correspondent, and I was there for the endless succession of 50th anniversary commemorations of the invasion of Normandy, the Battle of the Bulge, the end of the war in Europe. And I had a hypothesis that really the great events in American history are bottomless. There's always more to write. And I believe that's true about World War II. I believe it's true about the great figures in American history. People will be writing books about Abraham Lincoln long after we're gone. And then another little epiphany that I had was that the liberation of Europe didn't start in Europe. It starts where the Americans first get into the war against Germany and Italy, and that's North Africa. And in fact, the invasion of North Africa with the British in November 1942 is where the liberation of Europe begins. And so what I saw was a three-part tale, a triptych, three panels, really. The first campaign is in North Africa. That's where the story starts. The second is when they move 100 miles across the Mediterranean to Sicily and then into mainland Italy in 1943. And then that sets up that final great act beginning in Normandy in June of 1944 through the end of the war in Europe in May 1945. So I saw this structure and somewhat acted on faith. I was not a military historian. I was not accustomed to working in archives, but somewhat on faith believed that I could bring something new to the story.
What did you learn about your ability to work in archives?
I mean, you know, I found that I am a total archive rat.
It's obvious.
It's not for everybody, but I really enjoy it. The mystery of the next unopened archival box is what has to keep you going because it can be extremely tedious. It's very solitary, even within the solitary profession of being an author. And I found that I like it. And consequently, for the World War II books, I travel to many different archives, large and small, around the country, including that one in Oklahoma City I mentioned. I spent a lot of time at the National Archives in College Park, Maryland. It's not far from where I live in Washington, D.C. I go to the British Archives, the Library of Congress, again, not far from where I live. And, I find that that lends an authenticity to what you're writing about. And it's how you move beyond, how you answer that question of, well, there have been 60,000 or so hardcover titles on World War II. What else is there to say? Turns out there's quite a bit to say because the archives are very deep and they're very broad. And there's still wonderful things to discover.
My guest today is Rick Atkinson, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and military historian. He is receiving this year's Peggy Helmrick Distinguished Author Award from the Tulsa Library Trust. The public presentation will be this Saturday morning at 10:30 at the Hardesty Regional Library, and he joins us today by phone here on Studio Tulsa. That approach to how you tell this huge story of America's involvement in World War II has been described by, I believe it's one critic, as pointillistic history. The idea that you're telling little tiny stories, little details that sort of broaden into this huge painting at some point. And I was wondering what you thought of that idea, this idea of telling lots of stories. Like you begin The Guns at Last Light with a whole series of stories of the privations the British people had as this huge American army comes over and occupies Britain, the rationing, all of the social and cultural clashes between the two cultures, but eventually coming together for a common goal.
Yeah, that notion that I'm a pointillist is something that was in the New York Times, and I sort of scratched my head a bit and thought, well, I think that's nice. I think that's a compliment. Last month, I happened to be in Chicago, and I went to the Chicago Art Institute, and I studied the Seurat paintings they've got there. He's the great French 19th century pointillist, thinking, is that what I'm doing? if only I could be that good. I think that's probably my technique. I do feel that the devil is in the details, that it's through the when you're a nonfiction writer, the imagination has to come into play, but it has to be the imagination of the reader. I can't make things up. They must be true. And I have a tacit pact with the reader that what I am writing is accurate, that it's true, that it really happened. But it's all in the service of the reader's imagination so that I can animate the scene that I am describing, so that it plays out in the reader's mind, that they can see in the mind's eye people moving across the room. They can hear them speaking. They can get the sense of what London was like in the late spring of 1944, having been through 5 years of war and some horrible privations, as you say. So I'm always looking for detail. I'm always it's always a search for granularity. You never have enough. I'm always trying to find a little more about something that I'm looking at, whether it's somebody's personality, whether it's an episode that happened long ago. So I think that the detail, the accumulation of detail, and the judicious rendering of it is really what the narrative art comes down to.
Of course, being that archive rat that you're talking about, you're also looking for great descriptors that help you tell the story. And, you know, certainly the great men have plenty of you know, the Eisenhowers, the Montgomerys, the Pattons, even the great division commanders like Trescott and the like. They have plenty of sources about them. But I think what really helps a writer such as yourself is these lesser known documents that sort of shed light. Who are some interesting sources that sort of help you put this big story into context from their own writings? I'm thinking of somebody like, for example, in the last book, Patton's son-in-law, Lieutenant Colonel John Waters, who was a POW and sort of kept this copious list of everything that he was consuming in captivity.
He's a fascinating character. By chance, John K. Waters was a West Pointer. He was a young, talented armor officer. He was captured in North Africa on Valentine's Day, 1943, at the beginning of the German offensive, German and Italian offensive that we know as the Battle of Kasserine Pass. And he spent the rest of the war in German prison camps, first in Poland and then in Germany proper. His son, by sheer chance, my father worked for eventually four-star General Waters in the 1960s, but his son, George Patton's grandson, had gotten in touch with me at one point, and I knew a bit about his dad's war, partly because George Patton launched in 1945 a very ill-considered effort to rescue his son-in-law, whom he adored, from a German prison camp in Bavaria. It ended badly. I write about it at length. But Colonel Waters' son told me that his dad had kept in prison a very detailed pair of documents. One was actually a log of the rations that were given to prisoners at the time, and it was very, very meager. There were starvation diets. And then he kept a scrapbook of sorts, and among other things, he would paste into the scrapbooks the labels off of Red Cross food cans that occasionally came to them. So cans of peaches, for example, he would peel the label off and paste it into his scrapbook as if to extract a few final calories from the memories. So I use those. I use Colonel Waters' accounts. And there are lots of records of, among other things, the capture in North Africa, all the way through the harebrained effort by General Patton to free these prisoners in the spring of 1945. And he helps to, first of all, shed light on General Patton, who's a large character in all three of my books, but also you go down the food chain a bit and you see what his war is like, somebody who's not at the top, somebody who's actually had a very short war as a combat officer and a very long, difficult war as an officer in prison.
Yeah. Now, I understand you're working on another trilogy now after this, the great success of the Liberation Trilogy. You're working on a trilogy on the American Revolution.
I am. I've been at it for about 2.5 years. Again, being the archive rat that I am, spending a lot of time in archives that are quite different from the World War II archives. I finished the World War II trilogy, and the obvious, I suppose, natural thing would have been to pivot to the Pacific, and I just didn't want to do that. I would have had to start the war over again, for one thing, at Pearl Harbor or earlier. And I just wanted to try something else, and so I decided to delve into something that had been a particular interest and actually a fascination of mine since I was a kid. The American Revolution is our creation myth. The characters are every bit as fascinating as those in World War II. The consequences are every bit as important to us in America as the consequences of World War II. So I've been at it. It's not that I'm wedded to the trilogy as the inevitable format for narrative history. I just find that that's the way the story breaks in the Revolution. So the first volume will be set in 1775-76. It will end with the Battle of Princeton, which is January 3rd, 1777. And I'm spending a lot of time looking at the British. The British fascinate me. How could they lose? How could they lose? And yet they do. And so I've got another 7 or 8 months of research to do, and then I'll start putting that first volume together.
Well, it's interesting because for every historian that says, how could they lose, there are other historians that say, how could they ever win?
Well,
you know,
yeah.
It's the same sort of
that's
thing.
That's true. all of the wars that I've written about, and this is the fifth war, are expeditionary wars, meaning you got to go someplace to get there to fight the war. It's true in the Revolution. We have an expedition to Canada in 1775. It ends badly in 76. We're trying to make Canada the 14th colony. That is a very difficult expedition in the 18th century. For the British, they're obviously trying to transport everything from gunpowder to horses across the North Atlantic, often in the winter. So you look at their logistics problems, and you do come to that conclusion. How could they ever have thought they would win? Obviously, they're looking for a political victory, and it doesn't work out for them as they anticipate, partly because they've got bad intelligence about exactly who these rascals are who've declared their independence. So, yeah, all of that is, again, in warfare, there are certain eternal verities, and being able to project power, if you're going to wage expeditionary warfare, is essential. And we see when it's done well, as it is for the United States in World War II, you usually end up winning. When it's done badly, you usually end up losing.
Yeah. Well, we wish you great success on the Peggy V. Helmreich Distinguished Author Award, which takes place Saturday morning at 10:30. My guest today, Rick Atkinson, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and military historian. In our last minute, we mentioned earlier that you started your reporting career just up the road in Pittsburgh, Kansas, working for the Morning Sun. What sort of things did you cover there?
Oh, in a little newsroom like that, I think there were 7 people who worked in that newsroom. Paper published 6 days a week. A reporter covered everything. So I covered Crawford County issues. I covered the cop shop, as reporters call it, police issues. If it happened in greater Pittsburgh, I was one of the few reporters responsible for it. And it was a great place to learn the craft of reporting, a great place to fall in love with newspapers, and a great place to begin as a professional writer, earning the princely sum of $125 a week.
Well, we wish you great success with the next trilogy and, of course, marvel at the Liberation Trilogy, and look forward to meeting you this weekend. Rick Atkinson, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks. It was my great pleasure.
Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and military historian Rick Atkinson speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His most recent book is titled The Guns That Last Light, The War in Europe, 1944 to 1945, the final volume of his Liberation Trilogy. He's the winner of this year's Peggy V. Helmreich Distinguished Author Award from the Tulsa Library Trust. He'll receive that award in a black tie ceremony Saturday evening. There'll be a public presentation, though, Saturday morning at 10:30 at the Hardesty Regional Library, which is free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.